Well, this is certainly an interesting time of year. It's an interesting day of the year, I think. A winter solstice, the Tuesday before Christmas, and the confluence of a lot of holidays that merge during this time. Kwanzaa and Hanukkah, et cetera, et cetera. And so it feels like we should invoke a little bit of wonder in the talk this evening. So I'd like to start out with that, knowing this is our last discourse on the second foundation of mindfulness, vedana, or feelings. Feelings being the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutrality of the tone that's imparted with the tone that accompanies an experience and imparts a whole relationship for the individual toward that experience. But I want to back up just a little bit before we get into that aspect of tonight's talk and just speak a little bit about the cosmos, if I could. And the enormous explosion of and expansion of this universe, where I think they've discovered now that the stars, the number of stars that we thought were in the universe, have somehow sometimes increased sevenfold. So something like 300 times 10 to the 23rd, something like 300 septillion. Does that mean anything to you? Means nothing to me. A lot. It's a lot. But what I appreciate so much in terms of a Dharma understanding is that this universe is expanding outward, creating itself, creating the space it moves into from its own expanse. So it's creating the space that it's expanding into, which is itself a wondrous event. But each moment is a part of that expansion into something beyond what has ever been. So first of all, we have to realize that our place in the universe is central, in the sense that we're all points of the universe are essentially the center point of the universe. And so that all of us are equally as central to the expansion as all points within this space are. And that we are expanding out into something new and vast, something that has never occurred before, something that is that has never been. And it's a wild adventure of wonder, really, when you start sensing that this expansion involves us. We're also within that expansion, and we are moving out. As Ajahn Chah says, ultimately, you are merely observing the act of creation. Gives you a different sense of perspective, doesn't it, in things, in this wondrous of times of year when we begin to acknowledge what a consciousness can evolve into. And we begin to see that our consciousness is a part of that expanding consciousness, universal consciousness. And question would come up for anyone that could see that, even objectively, is that how can we claim possession of anything? How can we claim we possess something when it's constantly moving, expanding outward to something that it has never been, never could possibly be conceived, and moving into areas that it has not known before? Or, I mean, it's clear that we could see something, we could touch it, but how could we possess it? How is that possible, that you could hold fast to something that was moving right in front of your eyes, out of your reach. And perhaps a different question is, how could we ever fixate ourselves within that expansion? How could we ever hold ourselves to be true in one moment, everlastingly so? How could we ever claim a reference for ourselves that was a fixation in time and place, when time and place are all relatively moving and expanding outward in this journey of wonder? You might think that the only way we could adequately enter this mix and have any relationship to it would be to ask questions about it, would be to stay in the state of wonder that a question imposes, even as the expanse moved into wonder. And I love that fact because, in fact, a seat, a Dharma seat, really does include that sense of exploration, that sense of questioning, of inquiry, of looking, never fixating a response, never determining exactly what is, but always moving, always expanding. As that question, as the poem I read tonight, very deliberately, imposes a kind of sense that the same questions have come forever in the course of the human life, and that we're just pondering the same themes, but each of us have to investigate our lives into this so that we can come to that unfixed determinant as we move outward and expand with the solar systems. And so I like to think that every time we create a sense of I or possess something, we're actually doing the reverse. We're halting creativity. We're arresting what is creatively known. We're arresting the very nature of becoming itself. So tonight I'd like to look at several ways that we can break up that fixation. And as the last talk in this particular foundation, some of this will be a review of what has already been said, but I think it looks at how we can actively, in terms of our life, take a dharmic stance so that we can keep this thing flowing and moving and expanding and being creative and always moving outward rather than being fixated or possessing anything in particular. And so the first question I would pose or ask of us is, how do we break up that fixation? And what we have to understand in the first response to that is we have to explore what feelings can and cannot offer. We have rested our life. We have fixated our life, our dimension, our consciousness on asserting feelings as where we stand, as the posture of our life, as what we have as the ultimate goal, as the false nirvana of this dimension. We pursue them endlessly in all aspects of our life, never realizing that these are very unreliable experiences. A sense of pleasant or a sense of unpleasantness, an avoidance of unpleasantness, really is a very tentative, shaky thing. It's part of the expanding, creative, and always moving experience of the universe itself. We can arrest upon some detail of life and try to possess that moment with some duration and satisfaction, but it slips. Somebody pulls the rug out from under us. We feel shaky. We don't really understand any steadiness in it. We don't develop any ability to be comfortable, truly comfortable in it, because even as we touch the realm of comfort, that comfort is being slowly withdrawn from our life. And this leaves a kind of disturbance with us, a sort of fear, awkwardness, and for some a kind of doubting, that we haven't really put forth the effort necessary to make this life work. And in the way that we have been told that it can work, by everyone, there's a kind of doubt in ourselves, a little falling back that says, I'm not so sure I can do this. I'm not so sure it's even worth doing, but because that's too counter to the cultural traditions, to our leadership, it feels like that might not be the wise question. Maybe it's that I can't do it. Maybe that I'm just not able. Maybe I don't have the strength to make this life work. Maybe there's something missing in me. The fallback, the default position for most of us, is a sense of doubt. Is that sense of it's me that's the problem, not life. But a few of us who have gone through that self-brutality, and we have the reflective capacity to see, as we look out, that it's not working for anybody. As much as people try to establish that fact in manner and in speech, if you look, if you just scratch below the surface, you see someone who's very frightful and afraid that it's not working for them either. And so some of us begin to sense that the conditions on which we have rested, the very pursuit of the feeling tones that we have lived our life for, something must be wrong with that configuration, with that determination. Why? Because it doesn't work. It doesn't last. It doesn't give me any sense of real contentment. It gives me momentary comfort, but it doesn't give me any contentment. And if I look deeply into myself, I sense what I really want is contentment. I want to be able to relax. I want to be able to have a repose with life. A repose with life. But if we get, it's a little scary to ask these questions. So what happens to most of us is that we speed up. We keep our RPMs revved, and we move through life so quickly that we don't bother to look up and ask these fundamental and ancient questions about life. We just want to kind of get through it before we ask it, and then maybe on our deathbed we'll have a moment or two of reflection. And so one of the ways that we have sort of, in spirituality, brought forth a counter-universe, a counter-dimension, are through words or intonations that seem to indicate a kind of contentment, a kind of ease, a sort of resting place that can be outside of this pursuit and chasing of feelings. One of those words that I think is most often used in this tradition is the word equanimity. The word doesn't slide off my tongue very easily, because if I had a word that I could erase from the spiritual vocabulary, it would be that one. And perhaps love. I'm taking it on tonight. So why would I say that? Why would I say that? Because they are essentially misunderstood. Think how love is misunderstood. Think what it means in terms of romanticism and attachment, in terms of some ideal state. And because of that, it's pursued endlessly at the expense of its relevance, at the expense of its authentic and realized nature. And so too, equanimity has the same quality. It is invited as a word.